Counsel, you each have 15 minutes for your oral arguments today. The appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Please introduce yourself and your client upon commencement of your oral arguments. The appellant may proceed at this time.
Thanks, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Dan, last name Voss, V as in Victor, OSS. I'm appearing on behalf of the appellant, Bennett & Cook Construction, LLC, a licensed remodeler in the state of Minnesota since the early 2000s. When I was addressing the district court in the motion hearing, the court complained about having 3,000 to 4,000 pages of documents laid on its bench. The court characterized the motion as a motion, not as a motion, but really as a trial by paper. And I think that's a direct quote from the court. The fundamental legal tenet that was missed, and this is a fundamental legal tenet of our jurisprudence that was laid down long ago, is that a court may not examine the underlying evidence or record or otherwise delve into the merits of an arbitration award. If you look at page 6 of our reply brief, we cite to the Sankey case, which what I just stated is a direct quote from the Court of Appeals.
Mr. Voss, can I ask you to bring you back to the judge's order in the memorandum on page 3? That's kind of the beginning, I believe, of the memorandum, the court. And in the second, it's actually the third paragraph, the court does make reference to de novo review of an arbitration award. It cites the ID case, then it cites Johnson case, and then finishes off that paragraph with the 1928 case from the Supreme Court Itasca paper. Are you able to be specific with us as to what error regarding de novo that the court made in referencing those cases, if there is error?
There is error. De novo review by a court is only appropriate where the arbitrability of an issue is before the court. So whether the arbitration panel should be deciding a claim or issue. If you look at the Morrison case, which is cited in our brief, the court directly states that the only time that de novo review is appropriate is when the court is considering arbitrability of the claims or issues. It does not have the right or power to exercise de novo review outside of issues of arbitrability. The ID case, which I feel like I've addressed at length in our brief and in our reply brief, was a case involving the No Fault Arbitration Act. And that set of cases is altogether in its own category. No fault cases, arbitrators do not have the power to decide the law. The Minnesota Supreme Court in Johnson, which the ID case follows, stated that the courts are the final arbiter of the law under the No Fault Act. So these cases that are cited in regards to anything under the No Fault Act have no application here. The other case that you referenced on page, and I'm just turning to the court's order, so bear with me. The Itasca case, I urge you to read that. It was an insurance appraisal case. It has no application in our present jurisprudence under the Uniform Arbitration Act. It is not applicable. Under the law, the only time you can modify, the only time a court can modify an arbitration award is under one of three circumstances, which are set forth in 572B.24. One, that there was a mathematical calculation that was an error. Two, the arbitrator made an award on a claim not submitted to the arbitrator, and the award may be corrected without affecting the merits. Three, the award is imperfect in matter of form, not affecting the merits. And what we had here is an arbitration award. And if you have the addendum handy, the arbitrator specifically stated, no party is awarded attorney's fees as a prevailing party. Those are the merits. The district court not only vacated that, but it altogether changed who the prevailing party was.
Well, can I ask you about that issue? Because one of the, I think one of the points that you made and that the arbitrator obviously thought was correct was that the claims that were brought by Ms. Jones were for a huge amount, and she only recovered a very small portion of that amount. Is there anything that you can point us to in case law or the law that would say that that's an important consideration in determining who the prevailing party was?
Well, I would steer you away from that altogether.
Okay.
And here's why, because the district court is not supposed to be delving into the merits. So the district court's not retrying the case. If the only way that the court could do a meaningful review of who prevailed or who did not prevail, and in this instance, the district court said nobody prevailed. It was a draw. He said there is no prevailing party, which was one of the options. The only way that you could do a meaningful review of that is to hear the entire case, hear all the evidence, see the witnesses, watch their demeanor. So I do agree with the court that this de minimis amount, $9,000, in comparison to $153,000 of attorney's fees, I'll put it in this word, outrageous. That's 17 times the amount that was awarded to Jones. And it was an award, Your Honor, for punch list items. When the court was done, When the arbitrator was done, the arbitrator didn't say there was a breach of contract by Bennett and Cook. What it did is it made allowances. For example, the siding, we admit it wasn't completed. At the arbitration hearing, that was admitted. We didn't complete the siding. So the arbitrator took Bennett and Cook's number for what it would cost to complete the siding, marked it up 50%. And then it did the same thing with pinning the trusses underneath the portico. The same thing with all the other items that led to the $26,000. It took Bennett and Cook's numbers, which totaled about $17,000, marked them all up by 50% and made an award of $26,000, then set off the $17,000 and change and came up with a net award of $9,000. So I hope that kind of answers your question, but yes, it would be important if we were actually litigating who the prevailing party was to look at percentage wise. And
is that a factual issue or a legal issue?
That is a factual issue. And what I directed the district court to was the Morrison case, which is directly on point. And the court said, you cannot ask for a judicial determination of attorney's fees after arbitration because it was submitted to the arbitrator. That case is directly on point. The attempt to distinguish that case fails. The court said, regardless of whether it was arbitrated pursuant to the court's order or the agreement that the parties had for arbitration, it didn't matter.
Can I ask you about the law that's required? What is the law with regard to the district court's review and arbitration decision relative to the legal analysis? I have the case, you cited a case in your brief, the Kornweyer case, which which I understand says that they, you can't review it or set aside for a mistake of the law or our fact in the absence of fraud, mistake in applying its own theory, conduct, or other disregard of duty. I think that's the, when can the district court get involved in reviewing the law?
It can't get involved in reviewing the law. The arbitrator is the final decision maker as to the law and the facts of the case.
Now, except there is no fault, except in no fault cases.
Except in no fault cases, correct, Your Honor. Or if there's a public policy exception, if there's an overriding public policy exception, and actually, if you look at MnSTAT 572B.23, which addresses vacation of awards, there is a public policy exception. The whole reason why we don't allow courts to delve into the merits is because they didn't try the case. They didn't hear the witnesses. They didn't weigh the evidence. Now, moving on to the award that was made to Bennett and Cook.
Mr. Voss, before you do that, I'm sorry.
Sure.
Can you comment on the Ramsey County case? And the judge referenced that at the beginning of page 4 and quoted the proposition that an arbitrator may not impose its own will. And I believe the respondent, to a great extent in the argument, is making the argument that indeed that's what the arbitrator did, therefore citing cases like maybe the Ramsey case itself for the proposition that the arbitrator exceeded its authority.
I would urge you to read that case. We cited as well, although we haven't selectively cited what is stated in the case. Now, if you look at the case, the court in Ramsey went on to develop what is known as an essence test. And when you look at the essence test, just bear with me for a moment. The essence of the contract needs to be looked at. And that means you look at the context of the contract. You look at the conduct of the parties. And that's exactly what the Supreme Court and Ramsey said. And this plays into this issue about the award that was made to my client. The arbitrator is a seasoned construction law attorney. He understood that Ms. Jones was living at the property the entire time this work was taking place. She, by her conduct, both directing my client to perform extra work and by sitting back silently, consented to the additional work, the extra work. Arbitrator Bistrom referenced the change orders, but he also understood the law. And the cases that we cite, which are the New Ulm case and the
while you're looking for that, Mr. Voss, though, just to clarify
the RJ Markle construction case, I'm sorry.
I just wanted to clarify, though, your main argument, the error is the district court ought not to reexamine the merits.
Correct.
Okay.
Yes. And the case that I directed the court to at the outset, which is the Sankey case, that's exactly what the Court of Appeals said, relying on other precedents. The court is not to sit in judgment of what the arbitrator decided. It is not retrying the case. And that's the fundamental error that I see that the district court made, was it was directed down a path in which it was told to retry the case. And in fact, at the hearing, that's exactly how the district court characterized it, called it a paper trial. Thank you.
All right, the respondent may proceed at this time.
May it please the court. Counsel, my name is Brenda Sorrow. I'm here on behalf of the respondent, Denise Jones, and I believe she may be listening in as well. We are asking that this court affirm the district court in all respects. The district court got it right. It took an award that was clearly beyond the bounds of the contract, that exceeded the arbitrator's authority, that was illogical in its own conclusions. You can't have 2 + 2 = -5. And that's exactly what we had here. We had Ms. Jones getting a net award. We had her being awarded pre-judgment interest, which by statute is only available to the prevailing party. That's what the legislature has determined. And then we had an arbitrator take those sets of facts and say, no one is a prevailing party. And the arbitrator simply did not have that discretion under the contract from which the arbitrator had the authority to act in the first place.
Ms. Sorrow, now I understand it was your client who requested that all matters be arbitrated, and the judge signed an order staying all proceedings. Essentially, both parties agreed to that. Am I correct factually from the review of the record?
Well, what happened was the appellant filed a mechanics lien action. We filed a demand for arbitration because of the contract, which mandated all disputes between the parties be arbitrated. So the district court action was stayed. The appellant responded, filed a formal response, and that's at doc number 24, in which they counterclaimed for breach of contract. So that was all in front of the arbitrator.
Right. And so the point being, though, is your client had requested arbitration, and when the mechanics lien action started, requested the court, and essentially I saw the document, all attorneys signed. So it was an agreement by all parties that all matters related to this dispute, which would include the mechanics lien, the unjust enrichment claim by the appellant, as well as your client's claims, would be all submitted to the arbitrator.
I think the claims that were pled in the arbitration were submitted to the arbitrator. And I think that's where
are you able to direct me to a phrase or a sentence in any document that limits arbitration to that? All I saw was the court's file saying all these proceedings, and that's the proceeding actually commenced for mechanics lien by the appellant and their unjust enrichment claim, and your client's answer, I assume, was in there as well. My point being is everybody agreed to arbitration of these proceedings. There's no exclusion anywhere, at least identified that I'm aware of what was to be arbitrated.
Correct. And in the sequencing of events, so appellant filed the mechanics lien action, seeking redress under the lien and breach of contract. We filed for arbitration. They responded formally and counterclaimed in the arbitration, bringing only claims in front of the arbitrator for breach of contract. Whatever they had pled, I mean, the mechanics lien was obviously litigated within the context of the arbitration.
Just to clarify, though, you have both the arbitration, the direct action, and the civil court, which is what we're reviewing, all of which together were suspended by agreement. So that would include the unjust enrichment claim appellant.
I disagree on the unjust enrichment claim, because I think it was incumbent upon the appellant, who was represented by the same attorney, to bring that unjust enrichment claim into the arbitration by virtue of their demand or their response to our demand. They had to still answer in the arbitration. And by the time we got to that, they dropped the unjust enrichment claim. It's not in the answer to the arbitration demand. That's what I'm saying. So it wasn't properly in front of the arbitrator, number one. And number two,
was that, let me just ask this then. My main question, actually, this was not those, but leading up to, did at any time, did your client or perhaps appellant's counsel argue to the arbitrator an issue that's not arbitrable?
If I'm following the court's question, I believe that the way, if you read the arbitration award, the award to appellant was for damages beyond the contract. And so in that instance, the arbitrator didn't have the authority to rule because we had a fixed fee contract, which he acknowledges. He says it's an $80,000 contract that has specific contractual agreement as to if that price needs to be adjusted, right? There's a change order procedure that never occurred. So then you don't, as a contractor, get to come back around if there's a dispute 3.5 weeks later and just throw a lien on a property and tie up a property. And that's what the district court properly recognizes. The contract was fulfilled because Ms. Jones paid it in full. There was nothing.
Wasn't the error, though, and maybe this does get to the heart of my question, Ms. Sorrow, is the court was prohibited from considering the merits of either the law or the facts as when reviewing an arbitration award. So the only issues for exceeding authority would be whether an issue was arbitrable or not. And that sounds like the district court didn't address that. So I'm assuming the parties didn't argue that because it wasn't argued at the arbitration level. How might I be wrong in that summary of what I've read?
So the district court has the authority to determine if the arbitrator exceeded his authority under the statutes. We all know that. And under the case law, if the arbitrator doesn't enforce the plain language of the contract, that can be looked at by the district court. The arbitrator can't rewrite a contract and can't throw out 5 paragraphs of a contract, which is what this arbitrator did in getting this convoluted result that we were left with. The district court did what it needed to do, which is reconcile the contract with the award and make it read correctly. Because you can't have a breach of contract when somebody has fully performed, i.e. paid their share of the contract. So Ms. Jones paid it in full. So there was there's no remedy left for breach of contract because there was no unjust enrichment claim either before the arbitrator or allowed under the law. That's under the Caldes case. You can't have a mechanics lien based on an oral contract in Minnesota, all those statutory provisions.
Perhaps for my next question, I'll presume that to be true, although I'm not sure from the record where you can point me to that the issue of unjust enrichment or all issues that were before the district court are not before the arbitrator. But in the Ramsey County Supreme Court decision from 1981 that both parties have referenced, the court even there, and I'm quoting, thus it is well settled under Minnesota law that once arbitrability is established, the role of the judiciary does not encompass a reexamination of the merits on the case. So isn't that what the trial judge did here, and that would be in violation of that and all subsequent decisions regarding review of an arbitrator's award?
No, I don't believe that that's what the trial court did. I think the trial court looked at the fact that the arbitrator didn't follow the contract from which the arbitrator's own authority derived and threw out 5 paragraphs in rendering an award that then didn't make sense. And yes, some of the cases that have gone up on appeal involve the issue of arbitrability, but not all of them. And they're not all uninsured motorist cases either, as counsel suggested. A lot of them are labor relations cases. The Osceola case is a construction dispute. So it's and those all involve de novo review by the trial court of what went on at the arbitration. Did the arbitrator exceed the powers? Did its award draw the essence from the contract? Was the arbitrator dispensing its own form of justice, which we argue clearly this arbitrator was, and that's under the Stoltz-Nielsen case and the United Steelworkers case, from the Supreme Court of the United States to the Supreme Court of Minnesota. The courts are very clear that the trial court is supposed to do a de novo review, and in this case, we argue it did it correctly. The arbitrator's can't just run amok. You don't give up your rights just by going to arbitration. And when your contract says you're entitled to certain remedies, i.e. prevailing party shall be given legal fees and costs, the arbitrator has to enforce that. This wasn't a draw, as suggested by appellant. A draw would be 0-0. And if you read appellant's response and counterclaim, appellant argued for legal fees under the contract, and very clearly, and submitted a bill for twice what Ms. Jones's bill was, in fact. But if you look at paragraph 12 of the counterclaim, they call it out. The contract provides that the prevailing party shall recover attorney fees and costs. There was never a dispute between the parties who agreed to this contract that whoever prevails gets their attorney fees. That's why both sides submitted them. And to your question, Your Honor, earlier about prevailing and in any sort of mathematical analysis of the result, all of the case law says prevail. If you go to the Black's Law Dictionary, which is cited by our courts, it's also cited by the Supreme Court, prevail is the person in whom one gets a judgment. The only person here who prevailed, resulted in a judgment, was Respondent Jones. In fact, there's cases where the attorney or the amount recovered was way less than what the attorney fee bill was. And the courts have held that doesn't matter. Prevail just means that you win. And here we have a net verdict, any which way you cut it. We have prejudgment interest. If the arbitrator didn't want Ms. Jones to be categorized as the prevailing party, he didn't have to award her interest. And that interest—
Is this a matter of law or fact as to who the prevailing party is?
This is law. This is once you have somebody that gets a judgment, prevails, it could be a judgment by a dollar under the case law, that's the prevailing party.
I I'll ask the same question to you that I asked Mr. Voss. Why can't the arbitrator consider the amount that was initially claimed by your client in this arbitration in assessing whether there was a prevailing party or not? Because I understand your client was claiming hundreds of thousands of dollars of damages.
Because the law doesn't give him that discretion. Once she meets the legal definition of prevailing under Black's Law Dictionary, under all the cases we've cited in the brief, she is the prevailing. So there's no discretion. Unlike some of the cases where that has been an issue, those cases say the arbitrator shall determine who is the prevailing party.
Well, then I come back to that Cornora case, which basically says that unless we can find some fraud or mistake in applying his own theory, misconduct or other disregard of duty, that we can't set it aside for a mistake of law or fact, even assuming you're correct that the arbitrator applied the improper law. How do you get around that case?
Well, it's also his own theory and formula, right? Because he said he gave her a net award. His theory was she was entitled to interest, and he didn't carry that down to declare her the prevailing party. It's the same analysis. It's him exceeding his authority when the contract says prevailing party shall, and both parties acknowledge that that's what they bargained for. They bargained for that. They both submitted those fees to the arbitrator. They both argued for it in their pleadings.
Ms. Sauer, wouldn't we be going contrary to the Morrison case? It pretty clearly, in fact, in that case, I believe it was a $400,000 award that the hopeful recipient of attorney's fees had received, and this court refused to reverse an arbitrator's decision that there was no prevailing party in that case. Wouldn't we be directly reversing our own court? And that was after the court there confirmed all the law we've been talking about, that laws of the fact and the laws are left to the arbitrator.
Correct. I think the difference in the Morrison case is in the Morrison prevailing plaintiff was not given any pre judgment interest, which is only available to the prevailing party by statute. And there was no argument that I could see in Morrison that the arbitrator failed to follow their own logic, which we have extensively briefed in our briefs. So I think that's the difference here. And in Morrison, the appellant sought their own fees in the counterclaim and the contract before the arbitrator. I don't believe in the Morrison case, the losing party sought their fees as well. So here we have both sides seeking fees. We have the pre-award interest. And I think those factually distinguish the Morrison. And I think the dissent in Morrison is more on point with what we are dealing with here today.
All right. Well, thank you. Any other questions from either judge? All right. Very good. Thank you. Mr. Voss, you may proceed with your rebuttal.
Thanks, Your Honor. There is no dissent in Morrison. It was a unanimous decision. Morrison is directly on point. Once.
Could I ask you, though, I want to follow up with a point made by a respondent, that this was a mistake of the arbitrator in applying his own theory, because on one hand he says, oh, well, you're the prevailing party, you get prejudgment interest. And on the other hand, you're not the prevailing party for attorney's fees. Isn't that an inconsistency?
I don't see it as an inconsistency. If you look at his award, and I'm looking at it right now, no party is awarded attorney's fees as a prevailing party. He has the right to carve that part out. Certainly he has that right. And if you look at also the Jamar case, the Court of Appeals said in the Jamar case that the law in Minnesota with regard to prevailing party has no application in the arbitration setting. That's what it said in an unpublished decision. He gets to decide who's the prevailing party as to attorney's fees. He gets to decide who, if anybody, is the prevailing party as to costs and expenses, which is exactly what he did. In paragraph 2, he says, no party is awarded attorney's fees as a prevailing party, period. Then in number 3, he says, the administrative expenses and expenses of the arbitration shall be borne as incurred by the respective parties, period. His award of prejudgment interest, we're talking about a couple of $100s. That certainly was not his intent. And if there was any ambiguity in his award, Jones had a remedy. Go back to the arbitrator and ask for an explanation, or do what the appellant in Morrison did. Go back and ask again, can I have my attorney's fees? If you read the briefs in Morrison, they were asking for like $3 million as a damage award. So going back to the court's discussion or question about percentages, this arbitrator got it. He understood it. He understood that these claims were terribly inflated, that this matter was terribly over-litigated. I was not the attorney who represented Bennett and Cook at the arbitration. This matter was tendered and counsel was appointed for Bennett and Cook. So when it comes to the attorney's fees, Morrison is directly on point. Jamar tells you that you don't look at the law of Minnesota to determine who the prevailing party is. That this point being made about prejudgment interest, which amounts to a few $100s at most, is immaterial.
Now, I was just going to ask you if you could respond to Ms. Sauer's point in answer to my question that the arbitrator exceeded its authority because it addressed, at least we can discern from a remedy, your client's quantum merit basis in the civil action. If I understood her argument correctly, it was only the arbitration contract that was arbitratable, and therefore that would simply be the $80,000.
But it wasn't, because the slander of title claim that was made and the fact that we agreed to this stipulation, she prosecuted, Ms. Sorrell prosecuted in the arbitration, for slander of title claim. That meant that the arbitrator had to decide the validity of the lien, the amount of the lien. That was squarely put in his lap to decide. So in deciding that, I want you to look at the at this R.J. Markle construction case, because when there's extra work that has been asked to be done by the owner, and Ms. Sorrow admitted in her letter of May 22nd that $10,000 was owed to correct the flooring deflections, those floors had to be fixed in order to proceed with the contracted for work. New windows were put in the existing structure that were never specified in the plans. You don't get flooring deflections corrected. You don't get new windows for free. So ultimately what the arbitrator had to decide is what's the value of that? And he accepted 100% of what Bennett and Cook said was its value. He awarded 100% of the lien amount. Thank you.
All right, thank you. The matter was well briefed and argued. We will take it under advisement and issue a decision within the statutory period of time. Thank you.
Appreciate it.